Okay, it starts out with, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon. We dealt extensively with the identification of Belshazzar in chapter 5, that this is the son, the co-regent of the last king of Babylon, who was Nabonidus, and was actually doing most of the king stuff. And he is entitled king here because this is the fellow that Daniel would be dealing with on a regular basis. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, this is about 553 B.C., Daniel had a dream and visions of his head upon his bed. And when he wrote, then he wrote the dream and told and was told the sum of the matters. Daniel spake and said, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of the heavens strove upon the great sea. This is east, west, north, south. It's a general term. And four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse from one another. So we're going to go through this this succession of four beasts. And then we see this several times in Daniel, that you have the vision and then you have the interpretation. So the chapter is divided into two. We have the vision and then the vision explained. And it says the first one, verse 4, was like unto a lion and had eagle's wings. Lion is generally understood to be the king of beasts. This goes back to ancient times. This is one of the reasons why it was such a popular symbol. And we dealt with the fact that when Daniel wrote this, lions were found from basically Burma to South Africa and from Morocco to probably what is now Romania and everywhere in between, as long as it wasn't dense jungle or parching desert. They had a very, very wide range. Their fossil range goes all the way back to Peru and throughout North America. So at one time had the widest natural range of any mammal in history. That was all free. King of beasts. And the eagle, again used throughout history as a symbol of royalty, we see it on a lot of the standards in Europe and so on, is considered the king of the air, the king of the birds. And so he has, it's like a lion, but it has eagle's wings. Now we're going to see another creature that has wings, but they're not stipulated as to what kind of wings, as far as what kind of bird. This one had eagle's wings. And I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked. They were yanked off, snatched from this. And it was lifted up from the earth and was made to stand upon, the feet as a man, and a man's heart was given unto it. This one is very interesting. This has got some additions that you don't have, and some transformations that you don't have in some of the other ones. We start out with something that is noble, but also dangerous and strong and ferocious. And then the wings are plucked. Typically, when you see wings in the visions and so on, it's conveying not the idea that it can fly per se. It's conveying the idea of speed. There's a lot of animals that can move very fast running. In the United States, we've got, you go over to, Wyoming and so on, you got the pronghorn antelope. That is probably the second or third fastest animal on earth as far as being able to run. You go about 60 miles an hour in a sprint. Coyotes, believe it or not, are actually very fast. Coyote can run almost as fast as a racehorse. So we got a lot of fast animals, but, we got stuff that moves in the air a whole lot faster. And matter of fact, a lot of the, other than crows and jays, a lot of the stuff that we've got flying around the neighborhood here can move pretty quick. It was about, 6 weeks ago or so. I was driving down Third, which is the other one way opposite Meridian. I was heading north, and I was looking to the west, and I saw this huge flock of pigeons. Probably, I don't know, 100, 120 of them, and they were moving in formation. I mean, this whole giant flock of pigeons. And then I saw why they were doing that. There was a peregrine falcon up there making a dive at the flock. And of course, when they stay together, it's harder for the falcon to pick one out. But, a falcon in a stoop can go over 200 miles an hour. He's got actual baffles in front of his nostrils so he doesn't explode his lungs while he's diving. That's why he also has the things in front of his eyes to protect his eyes while he's doing this. Something that's moving in the air, fastest thing that the ancients especially would have had any idea of. And so the idea of the wings is to convey the idea of speed. So he's ferocious, the lion, he's got the wings for speed, and yet the wings are taken away. He loses the speed, he loses his ferocity, and he's made to stand up on his feet, and a man's heart is given unto him. Now this one is different than the others. Let's focus on this one, verse 4. We have, basically, in this chapter, we're dealing with the same succession of empires that we saw back in chapter 2. In chapter 2, we had the great huge figure that Nebuchadnezzar had dreamed. It had the head of gold, had the breast of silver, the loins of bronze, the legs of iron, the feet of clay or pottery mingled with the iron. And they went through and they discussed these things as far as that they are succeeding empires. Same thing is true here. First one, in Daniel, we start out, and the succession is always the same. As far, we don't skip anything or anywhere along the way. Might just be dealing with two of them, as we will be next week, but they're always in the right order and everything else. So, first one, who's the lion? Don't look at your notes.
Babylon.
Babylon. All right, Babylon. Now, understand that in much of Scripture, and we'll see this, it's actually in this chapter as well, that kingdoms and kings, the terms are interchangeable. It was Louis XIV, I think it was, that said, I am the state. In a lot of ways, that's true. A lot of ways, that's true. That a great king is the one who makes a kingdom. And for Babylon especially, the kingdom was Nebuchadnezzar. He is the one that built it, and then after he passed off the scene, it went into decline. And didn't last a whole lot longer after his death, about 20 years tops or so. And so it was him. The idea that he was this ferocious beast, he was noble, he was the king of beasts, a dangerous thing, he was fast, he had gathered up this empire in just a couple of decades, not even that long. And then all of a sudden, the wings are taken away, he's no longer a beast, he's standing like a man, and a man's heart is given unto him. Why is that? In this particular case, why is this? What happened to Nebuchadnezzar?
He had an encounter with God.
The madness humbled the king. The madness transformed the king. And his testimony is back there in chapter 4. And so in this particular case, we have, I think this is one of the reasons, by the way, why, even though Babylon is the smallest of these empires, and even though Babylon is also the briefest of these empires, it is held up to be the noblest of these empires. He is the head of gold. He is the lion. He is the one that has a man's heart given to him. He's no longer a beast. He's a man. Verse 5. And behold, another beast, a second like unto a bear. Now remember, it's giving descriptions. When you have visions of this sort, understand that Daniel is looking at something and he's describing it from his perspective, his understanding, his experience. And this is true with any of the biblical writers. When John is describing the things in Revelation, he is describing things based on his language, his experience, the things that he sees and knows. If we were to see the same things, we might describe it a little differently because we have different experience and so on. So this is from Daniel's perspective. And he sees something, it says in verse 5, that like a bear. Doesn't mean it was a bear, but it was like a bear. And it was raised up on one side and had three ribs in the mouth of it and between his teeth. And it said, arise, devour much flesh. Two things to note about this. It's leaning or listing. Three ribs. All right, it's leaning. It's got three ribs. When we get to Daniel chapter 8... either next week or the week following, depending on how far we get tonight, we're going to be dealing with a ram that represents this same empire. And it has two horns, and the horns are not even. You got two horns, and they're not even. And so this thing is leaning. It's sort of cockeyed there. And it's got three ribs in its mouth. All right. First, let's talk about why is it leaning? Because it's been laying down a long time, and it gets up, and one side is asleep, and it's like, oh, no, I got to sit here and wait until the tingle goes away. Why is it leaning? What's that? The power is divided. First, let's do an identification. Which empire succeeded Babylon? Medo-Persian. Now, it isn't, don't just say Persian, we got to say Medo-Persian. It's what is used here in Daniel. Later on, by the way, it's called the Persians sometimes come first, or the whole Medo part is just dropped. And it has to do with the fact that it started out, we talked about this a little bit last time, we were dealing with Cyaxares the second and so on, all the little interesting discussions we had last week regarding the identification of Darius the Mede. It started out with the Medes in the preeminence. But they had an alliance. You had a confederacy between these two kingdoms, but the kings were of the Medes, of the leaders of the whole thing. Persians had kings too, but the head was the Medes. The Medes had their empire. They had an alliance with the Persians. The Persians worked with the Medes. They were partners in this. And then Cyrus is a Persian. And we dealt last week that the last of the Median kings did not have a male heir, but he had a daughter, and he married her off to Cyrus. And when he passed off the scene, the kingdom shifted from the Medes to the Persians. They came last, but they were more powerful. And for the balance of the 150 plus years that the empire existed, the Persians were the kings. So, it's listing because it's two. You get two for one, all right? But the kings, during the bulk of the empire, were of the Persians. Three ribs. What are the three ribs? It says, arise, devour much flesh. An empire grows by devouring other nations. What are the three ribs? Baby back St. Louis style, what are they? They're the three primary nations that the Persians conquered. We're, of course, familiar with the one that they succeeded as far as our study here tonight, that they succeeded... conquered Babylon, the Chaldean Empire that was built by Nebuchadnezzar. There were two other empires that they conquered. One was we'll do the one that's least known, and that is the Lydians. The Lydian Empire. The Lydian Empire was the western half, basically, of what is now Turkey. The last king there was a fellow named Croesus. There used to be a figure of speech rich as Croesus because there were lots of mines of electrum in that area, which is a natural alloy of gold and silver. Lydians were also the first one to invent coinage. All right. Before that, you just weighed out your money, and they were the first ones to mint coins and put the king's mug on the money. All right. So they conquered the Lydians. Again. Neither one of these groups, by the way, were destroyed. They just sort of took over. They didn't totally wipe out these people. They didn't wipe out those people. They just came in and they took over. So you have the Lydians, and then in between, the most familiar one is they conquered Egypt. So the three ribs are Lydia, Egypt, and Babylon. And then, of course, they threw a bunch of stuff on top of that. So by the time the Persians were done, they had everything from Pakistan to Egypt to Turkey and Thrace, which would be extreme eastern Greece and parts of Bulgaria. So they had a big piece of territory. That was the largest empire up to that time in world history. Okay? Persians had a big, massive empire. And is a bear a real... And I don't recommend trying to outrun one, but is a bear a real fast-moving animal? Not as big, not as wild animals go, not as carnivores go. All right, a house cat can outrun a bear. If it's being chased by a bear, I guarantee you it can. A bear takes his time, gets there, takes care of business. All right, he's a lumbering creature. He's strong. He's powerful. That's how the Persians operated. Babylon, bang, 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 bang. The Persians, let's go over here. Let's conquer these folks. Okay, we've conquered these folks. Yeah, let's go over here. They took their time about it. And they built a big empire over a period of years. All right. Persia, verse 5. Verse 6. After this I beheld, and lo, another like a leopard. Like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl. So, bird wings. It's not specified to be an eagle. Four wings like a bird. And the beast also had four heads, and dominion was given unto it. We see dominion given to Nebuchadnezzar, that the idea there, wings, and also the idea of dominion, that he is going to gain his empire very quickly. Very quickly. Now, let's go with number one. Who succeeded the Persians? Who conquered the Persians? The Greeks. Somebody said... Alexander. All right. Yes and yes. All right. The Greeks. And Alexander was the guy that did it all. And he did it in about 10 years and he never lost a battle. Never. Started when he was about 19. And when he was done, his empire was everything the Persians had, plus those stands that we're familiar with, Uzbekistan and that area. That he took that area. Afghanistan was part of his empire. He also went west, and had Libya, Cyrene, that area. And he also had all of Greece that the Persians were never able to do. All right, so he had a massive, huge empire. And when he left home at about the age of 19 and started building his empire, he never ended up getting back home. He died at a prolonged debauched party in Babylon. And this guy who was a strapping, strong, disciplined guy, after his soldiers said, okay, we're done. We have done conquered the world. We want to go home. He's like, and he wasn't ready to quit. And so he went to Babylon and moped and partied and died at about the age of 32 or 33. Four heads. This is not the four winds. This is four heads, because when he died, he left an infant son as his heir. And he had four generals that were drooling over the empire and said, the only thing standing between us and empire is this little baby. And so the baby disappeared. And under mysterious circumstances. And the four generals divided the empire amongst themselves. One took the home turf of Greece. The other one took Thrace, that little European part of Turkey and so on, and the western end of Turkey. And then the other two guys divided the Asian and the African components. You had the Ptolemies. This is going to come in later on. This is going to be very important when we get to chapters 10 and 11. You had the Ptolemies in Egypt. Okay? And then you had the Seleucids. I don't even know if I'm doing this right. In Syria. And these two guys, the other ones, you don't need to know about them unless you're really fascinated with history, but as far as biblically is concerned, they don't make a whole lot of difference. The Ptolemies in Egypt and the Seleucids in Syria. The last of the Ptolemies, by the way, was some lady named Cleopatra. You might be familiar with her. The Seleucids, you had a number of the kings by the name of Antiochus, which is why by the time you get to the New Testament era, you have several cities by the name of Antioch, named after the kings of the Seleucids. These two guys did not like each other. And they fought a lot of wars against each other. And they also, because of that, they kept each other from gaining control of the whole eastern end of the Mediterranean. Otherwise, you would have had a new giant empire come in and, but these two guys fighting between themselves kept that from happening. We'll come back to them in a little bit. When it says a leopard, where are leopards found? They found Africa. Are there leopards in the Jungle Book?
Yes.
Yeah. What is Bagheera? Bagheera is a leopard. Are there leopards in China? Yes, there's leopards in China. Are there leopards in Manchuria? Yes, there are. That's north of that's like eastern Siberia. Eastern Siberia. Yes, there are leopards there too. Leopards have a very wide range. They're also found in Java, parts of Indonesia. They have a very wide, very, very wide range. There are still leopards in Turkey. There are still leopards in the Sinai today. Not very many, but there's still some. Now, there's another big cat. By the way, the word leopard means, it's based on a root word that means to be spotted. Is there another large speckled cat found in that same piece of real estate, or at least the part of real estate that matters as far as our empires are concerned?
A cheetah.
Cheetahs are found in sub-Saharan Africa. There are still a very few cheetahs in Iran today. There's still a few Asian cheetahs. They used to be found from India all the way across the Middle East, as long as there was enough grass to grow gazelles, and all the way down to South Africa. And they used to, here's an interesting thing, the Maharajas in India and some of the folks in Persia and so on, they used to catch them when they were young and train them like they would train falcons. They'd put the hoods over them and everything, and they used them to catch gazelles. Gotta be really, really, really rich to do that. By the way, they have also found that a trained pair of cheetahs is the best thing you can use to keep coyotes under control, because they can run faster than a coyote, and once they catch them, the coyote's out of business. But since it costs about $150,000 or $200,000 for a pair of cheetahs, it's not economically feasible. All right, to be spotted, fastest land animal on earth. All right, and a sprint can get close to 70 miles an hour. All right, it's not, doesn't have any duration, but it's a sprinter. It's fast. Another term for a cheetah is, because of the thing I just described to you, it's called a hunting leopard. Because it's a spotted cat. I think that the leopard described here is not the one that skulks around and you know, takes out things and then drags them up into a tree. I'm going to tell the story. I thought of that. There was somebody in India, and they're standing next to a sign, and it says, "Watch out for falling antelope." There was a sign at a national park in India, "Watch out for falling antelope," because or for falling deer, whatever it was, because the leopards were catching things and dragging it up into the trees so that the wolves and the jackals and the tigers wouldn't get it. And sometimes the deer, whatever, would fall out of the tree and land on somebody. And the comment was, "What? They don't say beware of leopards? Just beware of falling dead animals." It's fast. Alexander the Great died. He was succeeded by his four generals. And then it says in verse 7, "After this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly, and it had great iron teeth. And it devoured and brake in pieces and stamped the residue with the feet of it. And it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns." All right, before we get too far, let's do some initial identification. Who succeeded the Greeks? The Romans did. The Romans did something that had never been done before. When you look at the Babylonian Empire, when you look at the Assyrian Empire, when you look at the Egyptians to some extent, you look at the Persians and the Greeks, what you had basically was a confederacy. It may have been a confederacy by force or by intimidation, but you did not have a single government with local governors dealing with all the intricacies all the way down to the you know, bottom tier of the population. You didn't have that. All the head guys were interested in was making sure that there was not rebellion and that the money kept coming in and that their frontiers were relatively secure. That's all they cared about. The Romans did something entirely different. The Romans brought in serious control. The Romans had their troops stationed all over the place. Unless a province was so peaceful and so much enjoying their status that there was a few of them that they didn't even have soldiers there. They didn't need them. The people loved being part of Rome. Rome, once you were inside the Roman Empire, as long as you were paying your taxes and willing to yield to them, they protected you, and they did. We had something following, starting with the rule of Augustine, that you had Augustus Caesar, excuse me, who was the first emperor. That you had what is called the Pax Romana, the Roman peace. And they didn't have invaders for hundreds of years. You could operate. You didn't have to worry about the hordes coming into your city and looting everything. You had stability. You bought a piece of property, you could leave it to your children, and then their children, and then their children. For 6, 7, 8 generations, you had peace and tranquility, relatively. Rome brought all these things about because Rome was ruled, instead of by power alone, they were also ruled by law, at least theoretically. They had the idea of citizenship, that they were able to unite East and West under a single rule. And one of the amazing things about the Romans is here you have the Roman Empire starting, or Rome as a nation and so on, starting around 700 BC. When did they go out? 1453. That's when Istanbul, Constantinople fell to the Turks. They lasted that long. They lasted for over 2,000 years. There's not another nation on earth that's even come close to that. Number two, by the way, is England. England's been in existence without invasion, without yielding to invaders and so on for almost 1,000 years. And so you have this amazing thing that lasted. Now, let's also look at another thing. All right, Dave, we're going to do our dispensational chart. I'll use the colors if I need to or if I think they're going to be helpful. All right. We're going to do our dispensational chart. This is the history of what is and will be, period. Okay? We have a starting point way over here by the smiley face. And we're going to... Creation is the beginning. And when God created everything, he finished and he said it was very good. We have a period of time. Now, by the way, I'm not a strict Schofield dispensationalist. We'll work with that to some extent. I'll let you know where I disagree with them. We have a period of time, and it's probably brief. We know that it couldn't have been more than 100 years or so. Probably not even that long. Probably 80 years at the tops, and I think, frankly, more likely a matter of weeks or months. And I'll explain why. We have a dispensation. The first dispensation is the dispensation of innocence. In the material creation, there is no sin. Satan fell sometime in here, because Satan's a created being, and when God was done creating everything, it was still all very good. So somewhere along here, Satan fell. But the dispensation does not end until the fall of man, which affects all of material creation. And this ends with the fall, with sin. Adam and Eve are banished from the garden. The reason, by the way, we know that it didn't take that long is because we know how old Adam was when his third son was born. And he had to have had the two sons early enough before then so that they could grow and learn to hate each other and one kill the other before number three came along. And why do I think they weren't in the garden that long? Because there were no other kids before then. All right. Otherwise, they'd be born in innocence. Okay. Everybody was born in sin. We have the next dispensation. This is before the flood, which is going to end this one here. And this is called the dispensation of conscience. Dispensation of conscience. There's no scripture. Does God have some revelation to man? Yes, he does. Remember, Adam lives to be almost 1,000 years old. He's telling his great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandkids when they have their family reunions about what happened in the garden. And so the people of the earth would have known that. The smartest people you have ever heard of in your life were the people who lived at this time, even though they were fools. They are not too far from original creation. They had the brains that Adam gave them. And if you know somebody that's a savant, that they have just this amazing capability in language or in music or in art or in math, you name a subject, they just have this incredible talent. That's a savant. You take those people in all their different subjects and roll them into one person. That was Adam. All that was there before the corruption of sin. And he was created genetically perfect, as was his wife. And their children, for a number of succeeding generations, would have had the brains of their forefathers, minus just a little bit. Would have been an amazing people. And you know what they used? They used it for wickedness and evil. But they knew and rejected it. And even though they had the likes of Enoch, who was a preacher of righteousness, even though they had the likes of Noah, and by the way, between those three, and there may have been quite a few others that we don't know about, but between those three, you didn't have a period of time during this whole dispensation where you didn't have somebody telling them what was what. And they rejected it. So by the time we get to the end of the flood, how many people out of the very likely hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people that were on the earth, how many of them got on the ark? Eight. The flood ends the dispensation of conscience. And we have another one. Starts with getting off the ark. And it actually ends with Sinai. That's your Ten Commandments. Okay. You know what they look like because you've seen Charlton Heston hold them. All right. This is the age of promise. God made some promises. We have the Noahic covenant. I'll never send a flood again. And he gave some stipulations regarding human... Oh, I'm sorry, this is the one of human government. I'm sorry, I jumped over one. Let's scratch this. Flood. Human government. Based on the Noahic covenant. You had capital punishment instituted in Genesis chapter 9. Or Genesis chapter... Yeah, chapter 9. Which involves, by necessity... Otherwise you end up with anarchy and people just killing each other for the sake of killing each other. You have to have government. During this period of time, you had the creation of cities. You had the creation of empires. And it ends with two events that are probably very close to each other in time. One is Babylon, Babel, the dividing of the nations, which caused people to spread all over the earth. It's an interesting thing. The people who are in the remotest parts of the world, the people who live at the extreme southern tip of South America, Tierra del Fuego, the people who live in the Andaman Islands, which are between Sumatra and India, they have the, and also the, they're basically extinct now, at least versus pure-blooded, but also the Tasmanians, the people who lived in Tasmania, were the most remote people on earth, and also they have the purest DNA. They are not a mingled people. And so when the languages were confused, it's like dropping a pebble in a pool. And the weakest are out on the outsides because they keep getting chased by the people behind them who keep getting chased by the people behind them who keep getting chased by the people behind them. And the strongest are the ones that get to stay home. Which is why empires and nations and civilizations started in the Middle East. Because we started with civilization. And it's very difficult to build a civilization if you're always on the run. It's kind of interesting that the people in Polynesia had no access to clay, and yet they built baskets designed as what they looked like when they were had access to pottery. And so they chased each other all over the world. You know, when everybody was speaking the same language, there were no wars because there were no national conflicts because everybody was under the same umbrella. Interesting. Babylon happened. And then we also had a very key event biblically. This makes a whole lot more impact as far as the world at large at the time. But there's another event that's far, far, far more important. We have a guy named Abram. God calls a man named Abram. We have the Abrahamic covenant, Genesis chapter 12. He promises him a bunch of descendants. Some real estate, protection, I will bless those that bless you, curse those that curse you, and then the last one, the part that affects us, and through you shall all nations or all peoples of the earth be blessed. Now, I don't know about you, but I've never met Abraham. He's been gone for 4,000 years. What's the significance of the world blessing on Abraham? Through him came the Jewish people. Through the Jewish people came David. Through David came Messiah. When Abraham went to the land of promise without ever having seen it, talked to his real estate, his travel agent and so on, they didn't have any pictures or brochures at all, but he decided to go anyway. When he went unseen, he went because God told him to. And the only piece of real estate he owned was his tomb. But God had made a promise. And when his descendants went down into the land of Egypt, they went down to the land of Egypt on a promise. And Jacob and Joseph both told him, you're going to be coming out. And Joseph said, when you go, you'll take my bones and you'll bury them back in the land of promise. Because you're going back. And they did. Now, we come back to the Ten Commandments. So, for... depending on how you want to cut this, between 400 and 600 years, everything's based on a promise. And during this period of time, you go from one guy, one old guy who has no kids, but a promise, to between 1.5 million and 3 million people. And yes, you sit down with a calculator and you can get that many people in that amount of time without too much trouble. I told you, there's over 30 million people in the United States that can, that can legitimately trace their ancestry back to somebody that was on the Mayflower. And that was less time ago than this. All right. Sinai. They get the law. God says, you do this, I'll do this. You do this, I'll do this. You do this, I'll do this. And the people said, okay. All that the Lord has said, we will do. And then they promptly had the golden calf incident, and it's basically been a cycle of that kind of thing for the next 1,500 years. This is the age of law. Focus is on the nation Israel. The vast bulk of your Old Testament is this dispensation. It lasts approximately 1,500 years. It ends with the crucifixion. Because what happened when Christ said, it is finished, and the veil in the temple was torn? Law is superseded, it is fulfilled, we're done. And now we have something. The reason I have all this up here is because we got something that was not in the Old Testament. And if you're going to be able to understand Old Testament prophecy, you need to recognize that this is true. The dispensation we're in right now, Schofield called the Age of Grace. I don't like that because people have always been saved by grace. You go back over here and people were saved by grace. Salvation has always been by grace. It's not just this little window here. But we do have something that is unique to this dispensation. And what is that? It's the church. This has been, thus far, the longest dispensation. We've been in this one for over 1,900 years. And God is gathering up his people from every nation on earth. And through the centuries, I would suspect that through the centuries, there's got to be at least a billion of us by now, and maybe several billion. It's amazing how many people are going to be there when it's all said and done. We'll spend just the millennium getting acquainted. All right. Church age. This dispensation ends when we are called out of here. The rapture. We are out of here. And what God does is he resumes something. Because this dispensation here is a parenthesis. It does not exist in the Old Testament. The church is not in the Old Testament. This period of time that we live in right now is not in the Old Testament. Old Testament prophecy goes up to the crucifixion and resumes during this dispensation, which is the tribulation, which lasts seven lunar years, 360 days each. All right? The church age isn't there. So when you're looking at Old Testament prophecy, if you were to just squash these two together, that's how the prophets saw things. They didn't see this. This wasn't there. This was a great mystery. They knew that the Gentiles would receive the grace of God, but that's going to happen during the millennium too. They did not see this, see the Testament. Instead, you run the things together. And we see the example where Jesus was in the synagogue there in Nazareth. They hand him the scripture. He reads from Isaiah. He says, he's reading in Isaiah, and then he stops in mid-sentence, hands the scroll back to the attendant, and sits down to teach. By the way, they did that. They didn't stand up to teach. They sat down to teach. And everybody's looking at him, wondering, probably, why he stopped there. And he said, this day is the scripture fulfilled in your ears. And it had to do, everything he read had to deal with the first coming. Because the next phrase, the next clause, deals with the second. The prophets ran it together. No gaps as far as they could see. Which is also one of the reasons why the Jews were perplexed is how you can have a suffering and reigning, ruling Messiah. They didn't get it. They had a terrible time trying to figure that out. All right. Tribulation lasts 7 years. It ends with the return of the Lord and us too. Then you have the kingdom. And the kingdom is in two stages. We have the millennium, which deals with a fallen creation. And then we have the eternal state, which deals with a glorified creation and never ends. All right. There you go. Now you know what's going to happen tomorrow. Now, the reason I have all this up there is... Good. The reason I have all this up here, that's the one I want, is this. This window. This parenthesis is right there in Daniel. And we also saw it back in chapter 2. The legs represent, the iron legs of iron represent what? Help me out. Back in chapter 2, legs of iron of the image. Rome. Iron is Rome. This last beast is Rome. And who succeeds Rome in Daniel? From Daniel's perspective, what succeeds Rome? The kingdom does. The messianic kingdom does. Because Daniel doesn't see a division in Rome. He sees them run together. So when the church is taken out of here and the prophetic understanding resumes, you have Rome ruling the world at the crucifixion of Christ. And when the rapture takes place and the tribulation begins, who's in charge? Again, Rome. So this beast with the iron teeth and so on is Rome here and here. Because he doesn't see that there's a division, that there's a gap. It's not there in your Old Testament. Look long and hard. You won't find it. It's not there. Ironside was great, was right when he said that this is the great parentheses. So, we've got that fourth beast. And he conquers. And he maintains his power, as Rome did. Now, just as a slight digression, throughout history there's been a lot of people that claim to be the heirs of Rome. We talked about this back when we were dealing with chapter 2. I remember my grandmother singing this. Her older brother died in World War I, and he's saying, "We're all going calling on the Kaiser, because we got to teach the Kaiser to be wiser. Well, the English and the French and the Irish too, and we're all going calling on the Kaiser." All right, Kaiser is German for Caesar. All right, claiming, hoping to be the inheritor of the power of Rome. And further to the east, in the same era, you had a fellow named Tsar Nicholas II. And Tsar is Russian for Caesar. All right. And you had a lot of folks wanting to be this. And then the Pope claimed to be the Pontifex Maximus, which was one of the titles that the Roman emperors claimed. Different people wanting this, the power of Rome. And when this is all resumed, we will have a Rome again. Now, does this mean it's necessarily going to be in Rome? Doesn't have to be. The Roman Empire moved around during the course of the empire. It wasn't always in Rome. I mentioned that they finally came to extinction in 1453, and by that time it was at Constantinople. We have several emperors that never were in Rome. And some of them, even when Rome was theoretically the capital, they were never in Rome. Never had been there. Culturally, as you look at these successive empires, for the most part, they move west. Culturally, they move west. You start out with Babylon. I know the Persians are mostly north and slightly east, but the shift, as far as people is concerned ethnically, and as far as culturally, the shift is west. But then we go to the Greeks, and then we go to the Romans. And as far as culture is concerned, the west, of which North America and the Western Hemisphere is part of culturally, are the inheritors of Rome's culture. We are a rule by law. We have our governmental structure to some extent after the Romans. We operate culturally and a whole host of other things. Our background is Greek and Roman in so many ways. And the West is the inheritors of this. Now, is there an empire in place? No. No, there has not been even close to an empire. Hitler tried, Napoleon tried, the British on a much, much, much more benign level tried, and nobody succeeded. There has not been an empire like Rome, or even remotely close to Rome since Rome. And so when this resumes, when we get to the tribulation, you're going to have Rome again. Now, time is up. Save your notes. We'll pick this up next time, and we are at verse 7. Okay? Any further questions or comments? If you have a question that I'm going to be getting to next time, I'll put you off. Any questions or comments on what we've looked at so far tonight? All right, let's close in prayer. Father, thank you for your word. Father, thank you that you know the end from the beginning. And here we are reading about a vision that a man had 2,500 years ago, more than that. And he's telling us of things that have happened long after his death, but long ago from our perspective. And he's also telling us of things that have yet to happen. Father, because you know, and you know the end from the beginning, Father, may we take you at your word. And Father, thank you for this revelation to us. We pray for Christ's sake. Amen.